Iku iluna, please rise.
Ohea o ko e ko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua o kea aha. Ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o kumaku aina o Hawaii. Inaui mai, imaliu mai, ilohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw an eye. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Inoho ilalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-20-481, State versus Vaden. Arguing for the petitioner, Ben Lowenthal. Arguing for the respondent, Richard B. Rost, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Lowenthal, Mr. Rost. Are you both ready to proceed today? Very well. You both have 30 minutes. Mr. Lowenthal, we'll give you a warning, yellow light when you're 10 minutes in. With 10 minutes to go. And Mr. Rost will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. And may it please the court. The question before the court is how to deduct credit that has been earned in a consecutive sentence. In order to avoid a double jeopardy violation, in order to prevent the unlawful extension of a statutory maximum, and in order to be consistent with this court's prohibition against extinguishing credit in one case and transferring it to another, credit must be given where credit is due. And the credit must be deducted in the case before us. The ICA and the Circuit Court and the Department of Public Safety have all extended the case of State versus Tau Ili Ili to a type of consecutive sentence that has no place. In order to harmonize Tau Ili Ili with the other line of cases of March, Kami, Bryant, and the ICA's Yamasaki case, Tau Ili Ili needs to be limited to the kind of consecutive sentence in which counts are running consecutively within one charge. That did not happen here, and the extension of Tau Ili Ili to this kind of consecutive sentence is the error. Mr. Vaden was improperly, unlawfully sentenced to 10 years, and by my calculation, 340 days, because those 340 days were not credited here.
Mr. Lowenthal, I have a question. Is this common on Maui for there to be an agreement that if there's a failure to complete drug court, there's going to be consecutive sentences?
No, consecutive sentences are an exception to the rule normally, and it is uncommon to have it as a stipulated sentence as part of an agreement.
Okay. And I was trying to find the record, but it doesn't appear that the transcripts of the original sentencing or the resentencing at the time. Well, was there a hearing on the resentencing when the consecutive was actually given?
So Mr. Vaden was sentenced to these offenses, I believe, three times. And so the third time was at the after the termination hearing in which he was sentenced to the imprisonment.
Right. So there was a hearing, right?
Yes.
We just don't have the transcript of that.
That is correct. The procedural posture in this case does come as a post-judgment Rule 35 motion.
Okay.
Frankly, Mr. Vaden understood the sentence. It wasn't until learning that he was not being credited the 340 days in which the motion to correct and clarify was filed.
Okay, but there's been no other claims raised with respect to the consecutive sentence?
That's correct.
Could I follow up on Justice McKinnon's questions, Mr. Lowenthal? If you could help me just to understand the record. Is it your understanding that what took place here is that there was a agreement that allowed for Mr. Vaden to go into drug court that stipulated that if he were not to be successful, he would receive consecutive sentences. And if that's the case, wouldn't that be an illegal sentence from the point of view that he was entitled to have some level of analysis or some hearing by the judge before determining that he would receive consecutive sentences in this case?
I understand the question, and it does raise intriguing issues as to whether a court's articulation on the record before imposing a consecutive sentence could be justified merely because it was agreed upon by the parties.
Well, for example, would it be the case that Mr. Vaden would go into drug court and perhaps commit a minor violation, and such as not reporting to the probation officer, and under the terms of this agreement would receive 15 years of incarceration?
Well, I think one of the issues in the case, or the other part of the plea agreement, was that the state agreed to dismiss the Class A felony and in exchange for that, provide Mr. Vaden with the opportunity for drug court.
Sure, but nonetheless, I mean, it does set him up for a circumstance in which, regardless of the nature of the violation, if he is terminated from drug court, he receives 15 years. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
I guess, Mr. Lono, the question is whether the court can essentially bind itself to a subsequent sentence. If there's a plea agreement suggesting that if there's a violation, the defendant receive a consecutive term. What's your viewpoint on that?
I believe that the court would not be necessarily bound to the terms of the agreement, as this was not a Rule 11 or anything like that. And the sentencing court should be cautious before imposing something like that, regardless of the agreement of the parties, and that there is always that area for discretion for the sentencing court before signing off on the agreement or adopting the plea agreement at sentencing.
Go ahead.
Follow up on what Justice McKenna was talking about in the record. You know, the plea agreement, the change of plea form initially before Judge Cardoza did have written in typed form. There are some handwritten portions, though, that says the defendant understands that if defendant does not successfully complete the Maui drug court program, the state, and then in some handwritten forms, is going to seek consecutive sentencing. And then, in fact, at the sentencing hearing before Judge Bisson, right off the bat, he seemed to ask, well, this is a plea agreement case. And then you said, yes, it was. And then he said, this sentence of consecutive sentencing was agreed upon by the parties. And you said, that's right. So it seemed to me that it was almost a done deal that the judge, if there was a violation of the drug court policies, Vaden's going to get consec. Is that illegal? Can courts do that? Or is it just sort of going against the whole sentencing framework that the courts have discretion, the courts need to do 706-606, courts need to, at least in sentencing, look at the Berrios case and make reasons and findings?
In preparing for the case, I did consider kind of its underlying issue as to the legality of the sentence, the propriety of the consecutive sentence, given the nature of the termination or the grounds for the termination here. And I do believe that just because there is an agreement in order to get into drug court, the defendant and the state agree to say a consecutive sentence, it does not necessarily mean that it is a done deal. It is still left to the court to make those relevant findings. The issue that had come up did not arise until after the sentencing. None of the objections were made to preserve on record, frankly, and the issue of jail credit was the main concern for Mr. Vaden, which prompted the motion.
Let me ask you about that, if I may. You know, the ICA rejected your contention that the 706-671 subsection 2 applied to Vaden before sentencing. But then the ICA went on to say that, you know, both subsections 1 and 2 are in play, but it really doesn't matter because Vaden can't get, you know, double credit for any of the cases.
And, you know, both sides didn't brief or really address the distinction between 706, 671, subsections 1 and 2. You focused a lot on distinguishing Tawili. But don't you think, I guess what's really more important is not the number of cases, but really the distinction between pre-sentence under 706, 671 credit, and I'll call it post-sentence or probation incarceration sentence under subsection 2. Isn't that the crux of the case here?
In approaching it, I think there are two main problems with the ICA's analysis and the circuit court's ruling, and they are related. One is what I had focused on with Tau'ili'ili and the distinction between counts and cases. But absolutely, there is a distinction between subsection 1 and subsection 2. Subsection 2 is dealing with a resentencing situation, whether it be after a revocation of probation or even on remand from an appellate court, and there be a new sentence. Subsection 1 does deal with pre-sentence credit, and subsection 1 doesn't necessarily implicate the double jeopardy problem because we're not dealing with multiple punishments for the same offenses. In that sense, yes, there is this distinction. And I do believe that Tau'ili'ili is a better fit with subsection 1 because of the what we call the equalization rationale between a person who can't afford to bail out and a person who can. That rationale has no place in subsection 2. But the reason why we still need to address the problem with Tau'ili'ili's application here is because, in a sense, subsections 1 and 2 both apply and does not resolve the question of the applicability of Tau'ili'ili. Because if you look at the procedure in this case from the arrest on the warrant that followed the indictment to the first sentencing of probation, that is arguably subsection 1. And then from there on, it becomes subsection 2 because we're dealing with resentences. We're still confronted with this problem of a consecutive sentence to other cases. And so I wish I had a clearer answer, but I do think that we are dealing with a statutory problem with subsection 1 and 2 and a broader case distinction between Tau'ili'ili and the line of cases like Cammy and March.
Well, to the extent 2 applies, what should the rule be? There is a period of time that you would concede it would appear section 2 is the applicable section. And by the way, at the very end, he's being held on a warrant at that. Again, I'm sorry, he's technically, I guess, pre-sentence again. But that, putting that issue aside for a moment, what is the appropriate rule under 2 as it applies to this case?
Under subsection 2, from the defendant is entitled, and Mr. Vaden would be entitled to all of the credit that had been earned from the first resentencing on. So I believe the first sentence was probation with 18 months, followed by a petition into drug court and a revocation and resentencing, followed by a termination, and then ultimately a third sentencing to imprisonment. Subsection 2 governs from resentencing. I mean, it's from the first sentence on. Subsection 1 would govern from the arrest on the indictment warrant to that first resentencing.
Which would subsection 2 apply to, the 5-year or the 10-year? You're saying that it applies to both.
Well, that's the ultimate question, right? Because Mr. Vaden was given one day of credit and none of the subsection 2 or one time.
What do you think? You think he should get the 341 for both consecutive counts, consecutive sentences, the full 341?
Yes. And the reason being is we look at cases individually. In just about every aspect of criminal law, we look at the individual facts, circumstances, when bail was set. We look at the individual case, and credit must be deducted in each individual case. It is actually a separate question when that sentence will begin. So credit should be deducted first, and if it is subsequent or consecutive to other sentences, then so be it. And so they are two separate questions in that sense.
Why wouldn't Tau'ili'ili govern the time up until the probation sentence was imposed? And then perhaps we could bifurcate, you know, and do a different analysis based on the different phase that the case is in.
Jail credit is calculated after the sentence is imposed. And the problem with Tau Ili Ili and the way it would and its attempt to apply it here is that Tau Ili Ili says we deduct once from the aggregate. And so this really does get a question as to what does aggregate mean? Our position is our aggregate means 10 years because a significant fact is that all four counts in this case were ordered concurrent to each other. And so the aggregate here is the 10-year imprisonment. It is not the other cases, because once we start doing that, that's when we're extinguishing credit earned in one case and saying it applied in the others.
And can you help me with that analysis with respect to subsection 2, the analysis as to the definition of, you were talking about cases, and if you could be a little more specific with respect to crime. The language says when a judgment of conviction or a sentence is vacated and a new sentence is thereafter imposed upon the defendant for the same crime, you know, the period of detention and imprisonment theretofore served shall be deducted. So crime, and you use the term cases. What are the crimes that you're referring to here when you are recommending that there be a deduction not only for the four concurrent cases, but the 10-year case as well? What? How do you define the term crime in this section?
It is our position that when we talk about crime as referenced in the jail credit statute, they're referring to the individual case.
And so what are the cases in this case?
So in this case, you have the four counts of promoting a dangerous drug in the second degree, two class Cs, counts 3 and 4, and count 5 is a misdemeanor.
You call that one of the crimes?
Those would be what we would call the crime that they're referring to.
Okay.
And the reason why is because
how many crimes are we referring to under section 2 then?
I believe it would be for the...
Are we referring to two crimes, the crimes so-called that are constituted by the concurrent and an additional crime that constitutes the 10-year increment on the consecutive?
I believe we're only referring to the single case. And the reason why I keep going back to the word case as opposed to say the word crime, which is in the statute, is the statute does not contemplate running credit from one case to another. It shouldn't be read, or our position at least, is that it shouldn't be read with regard to jail credit in other cases. So when
you say it, I'm still wondering how you define crime. What are the crimes in this case?
I would say it would be the four counts in the indictment that he ultimately pleaded to and was sentenced
to. That's a crime.
Yes.
And the other? Is there another crime?
There would be no other in this case. And the reason being is, you know, the prosecution is governed by, I believe it's Rule 8, Rule 14, to prevent unprejudicial joinder. You can't just put whatever offenses one wants into a single charging document. There needs to be some sort of nexus or connection.
You don't describe the concurrent terms of the four different offenses under the concurrent sentence. You don't define that as a different crime than the crime that is constituted by the 10-year sentence.
I see.
Or do you? Are those two different crimes? Because I thought the analysis that you were suggesting is that you apply credit for each of those, for the 10-year increment and the increment of the concurrent, the other four concurrent terms.
I would say that under the terms of the statute, it could be read that the crimes could be each individual count. However, given the court's ruling in Tau Ili Ili, we are dealing, which prohibits deducting credit for each individual count when they are running concurrent consecutively. We're not asking to overrule that necessarily. I don't believe the court would need to overrule that in this situation because The counts here were running concurrently. But that question as to is the crime the individual counts or not, there is a reading that can be made that under that statute, we could look to the individual counts. However, given the state of the law with Tau Ili Ili on consecutive counts versus concurrent counts, the court, we're not asking to necessarily overrule Tau Ili Ili. We're asking it to limit it to consecutive counts within a single case.
Counsel, are you arguing that Tau Ili Ili is distinguishable or that it was wrongfully decided?
We are arguing today that it is distinguishable in this type of consecutive sentence. Now, whether the court wishes to revisit Tau Ili Ili to see if individual counts should be deducted can be left for another day, but it does raise those questions as to whether that is still settled law or not. At the very least, it is distinguishable when we're dealing with the kind of consecutive sentence where cases run consecutively as opposed to counts.
Mr. Lowenthal, if Tau Ili Ili says that you can't double dip on the pre-sentence credits, wouldn't giving Mr. Vaden the full 341 be double dipping on the pre-sentence credits for the present case, the 10-year case?
Our position is that no credit was given in this case because the Department of Public Safety only awarded one day.
So could he be allowed the Section 2 credits, but still apply Tau Ili Ili and not allow him the Section 1 credits?
That's kind of the part that's a little unclear or a little difficult to resolve, because subsection 1 and 2 contemplate a single case, whether it's pre-sentence credit or after a resentencing. The problem here is the lower courts looked beyond the contours of the single case to apply Tau Ili Ili. So I guess my answer to you is yes, Tau Ili Ili would apply, but we'd have to look at this single case, which is a concurrent 10. All the counts are concurrent to each other. It's an open 10. And if we were to apply Tau Ili Ili, we would have to deduct the 340 days, whether it be subsection 1 or 2.
Did Tau Ili Ili involve a resentencing?
No. It was I believe it was a plea agreement.
Doesn't 671 subsection 2 say when a judgment is vacated and a new sentence is thereafter imposed upon the defendant for the same crime, the period of detention and imprisonment theretofore served shall be deducted?
Yes.
From the minimum and maximum terms of the new sentence. So the issue is, it's kind of ambiguous.
Correct. And then you have the case of De Lima, which interprets subsection 2 to say that section doesn't apply only to cases on remand, but to resentencing after probation. And so that's why it aptly fits here. I believe with the language detention and sentence, that could contemplate covering even pre-sentence credit after the arrest on the warrant indictment. So I do stand corrected on that.
I'm sorry, you're saying this case would be governed completely by 2 as opposed to a combination? 1 and 2, depending on the period of time?
As Justice McKenna points out, that by including words like detention and sentence, it could be discussing...
Of course, the certificate that's supposed to be provided refers to the period of imprisonment served. So the statute seems to have somewhat contradictory terms. Is that right? Isn't that right?
Yes.
Can it also be construed that since this only applies to resentencing, there's already a certificate that has been provided for the original sentencing with respect to the detention, which is what actually happens? you have the pre-sentence detention credit already in the record based on the original sentence.
I under the statute, you're supposed to have the certificate. Whether the certificate is produced by the time of sentencing or not, there are practical problems with that.
Because the statute, subsection 2, talks about detention and imprisonment credit. Subsection 1 is detention. You know, it's the original sentencing. It requires a certificate for the pre-sentence detention credit. It's in the record. You already know what the pre-sentence detention credit was. So the only thing you need at the time of resentencing is the imprisonment credit, right?
Yes. That is correct.
So, I'm sorry. Go ahead, CJ.
No. Please go ahead with your question. I was just going to see if Mr. Lowenthal wanted to move on, but if you have a question, Justice Wilson, please.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to hold you up a little bit, Mr. Lowenthal, but I did need to get to Tawili Ely because I wanted, to the extent that you've considered this, I wanted to get your thoughts about this equalization principle, which seems to underlie Tawili Ely, which is the principle that we don't want to give credit to an individual who is being sentenced that's been held pretrial and put them in a different category than the defendant that gets to post bail.
Right.
If you give credit for this pretrial detention to the defendant that can't post bail, you're giving preference. And I'm unclear about why this judicial doctrine, because that doesn't appear in 706-671. Tawili Ely is just a judicial doctrine, right? So why would that necessarily be the policy of the legislature, because we're suggesting that's what the legislature wanted, as opposed to accepting the language in 706-671-2, which says that what it says, which is the individual will get credit if they were held pretrial. Because in that sense, it means under Section 2, where there's a resentencing and an individual has gotten a consecutive sentence, there has to sort of be a reconsideration of the consecutive sentence at that time, taking into consideration the person may get credit for it, and it to some extent addresses the degree to which we want to be incarcerating people without further reflection. So my question is, do we necessarily need to assume that the legislature didn't mean what it said in Section 2 about giving credit regardless of whether it's pretrial?
I believe when we get to Section 2 and we're talking about a resentencing situation, equalization is at its absolute weakest, if not inapplicable entirely, because whether a person is wealthy enough to post a bond or cannot afford it, we're dealing with a sentence that had been imposed and is now being reimposed. So the question of being able to bail out isn't even part of the equation. And that's why equalization under subsection 2 really has no place. I know that this court in the unpublished Thompson case discusses that in a footnote, which is raised in the petition in the moving papers.
Mr. Lontoff, if I may, I understand your rationale that Tawili Ely doesn't apply because we're talking about two different cases instead of two different counts in one case. But what's the rationale for allowing double dipping across two cases, but not allowing it across two counts in one case?
It's not our position that there was any double dipping necessarily in any of the cases. That the approach that we're asking is that when calculating credit from multiple cases, we don't look at when the sentences begin. We look at the credit accrued, deduct it, and then analyze when the sentence is to be served. If we do it that way and look at each individual case, there's no double dipping at all. Thank you. I've cut into my rebuttal time, and so I'll reserve. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lowenthal. We'll change the podium and then Mr. Ross. You may want to bring the mic up a little closer.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Please proceed.
Thank you. As the court's touched on, the touchstone of State versus Taulili was equalization. And the state would submit the equalization rationale applies equally to any period of time, whether it's pre-sentence or, in this case, the probation detention or imprisonment that the petitioner experienced. Because if we took a defendant who had the same sentence as petitioner, but was not ordered to serve jail time as a condition of probation and didn't have these additional days up until the point he violated probation and got this, and if he were to get the same sentence, under the rationale being advanced by petitioner, that hypothetical defendant who didn't have jail time as a condition of probation would serve more time in the aggregate. And that doesn't make sense. I don't see how you can say your service of jail time as a condition of probation is somehow special time that gets counted twice. That's the rationale that Taulili rejected for pretrial detention.
Well, I appreciate your analysis and focus on Taulili. So help me with this, Mr. Ross. You're saying that it doesn't make sense that a person that has to post bail doesn't get credit for, on resentencing, doesn't get credit for time served because it doesn't have time served, right? He doesn't have any time. He posted bail. Help me with, why is it unjust or why would it be necessary to take away credit for time served for the person that can't post bail? What is the difficulty? What would be the public policy problem with giving them credit? You say it's a double dipping. Well, the other aspect of it is you have a consecutive sentence. There's resentencing under Section 2. This period of incarceration is something that ends up having to be considered in the context of the sentence that's already been served. Maybe the legislature, you could say, maybe there's a rational basis from the point of view that over-incarceration can at times be something that would take place if you end up with a reimposition of a consecutive sentence after somebody's been sentenced. Maybe they don't need the consecutive sentence any longer. And in this case, you know, you've got an individual, correct me if I'm wrong, but he has no prior criminal history of significance before he was sentenced. These are drug cases, not violent cases. He was judged to be rehabilitatable because he went into drug court, right? So he ends up with what you might argue is a pretty brutal sentence, right? He gets 15 years simply because, correct me if I'm wrong, but simply because he didn't complete drug court after 6 months. So maybe that's a situation in which you reconsider the consecutive sentence and the individual who couldn't post bail does get credit for that period of time, even though it seems as though if he had posted bail, he wouldn't have the benefit of it. I don't see why the public policy of the legislature can't be such that the policy that we have in Taulili was unnecessary. But Taulili, I'm wondering whether we should reconsider Taulili.
Well, I would say Taulili was correctly decided because Taulili stands for the principle that one day in detention equals one day off your aggregate sentence, regardless.
Yeah, if you accept this equalization argument, but I'm curious about, is it really necessary to have an equalization argument from your point of
view? But the equalization referenced in Tawili'ili is not really, in terms of the commentary, the equalization is supposed to be between people that have served pretrial detention and people that haven't. And the commentary says you get the credit because you served. But from there, the court says, once credit has been granted, no additional purpose is served by granting a second or double credit against a later consecutive sentence, citing to an Arizona case. When I look at the Arizona statute, the language seems really different. But it says courts in other jurisdictions having similar statutes agree that a defendant who receives consecutive sentences is entitled to a pre-sentence credit only once against the aggregate. It talks about other cases. But don't we have to construe our own statute? Where in our statute does it say that you don't get pre-trial detention credit for a consecutive sentence? Where does it say that?
The literal language of the statute does not say that.
And doesn't the rule of lenity then say that the defendant should get the benefit of that doubt?
Well, if you were to apply that rule, then sure, yes. But I don't think you need to get to that rule, because the statute, when applying the statute, and that's what Tawili'ili did, looked at the aggregate and said, you know, again, as you were the court was discussing with Mr. Lowenthal, the statute is phrased in terms of crimes, not counts or cases.
But nothing in 671 subsection 1 says you don't get credit right on the consecutive.
That's true. There's no discussion of concurrent versus consecutive sentences in the statute.
So the court reads in Tawili'ili kind of adds a provision the legislature didn't put, which is an exception for consecutive sentences, right? The legislature didn't address consecutive sentences in 1 and 2 and might well have thought, well, with consecutive sentences, it's even more important that the person end up being given credit, because that's a pretty severe sentence and it's worth reconsidering.
That would be a very different decision than what Tawili'ili found, yes.
But let's say Tawili'ili is the law right now. But, you know, how does Tawili'ili's equalization principle, in other words, the need to put people who can post bail and people who can't post bail in the same situation, how does that have anything to do with the subsection 2 sentences when somebody's sentencing post-sentence imprisonment? Tawili'ili doesn't, it has nothing, they're serving their time. They would have no comparison with those who can bail out. So don't you think Tawili'ili doesn't apply to the subsection 2 situation?
Well, yes, insofar as Tawili'ili doesn't get into that, because that was not the situation before Tawili'ili. I would say the logic of Tawili'ili should apply in that situation, because you should still be trying to equalize the amount of time people spend in prison.
That logic, I mean, isn't subsection 2 really baking in protections on the double jeopardy clause? And if you don't credit somebody's sentence, for example, in this case, Vaden had a discretionary condition of probation sentence of 18 months. Now, he didn't serve the 18 months because he got into drug court. I think it was like February 14th. And then just a few weeks later, he gets into drug court, he gets revoked and then resentenced again. But he's in jail because he's actually not going to drug court yet. Those are post-sentence subsection 2 credits. That doesn't that implicate the double jeopardy clause, that May to July timeframe that Vaden's in there?
I don't think that implicates double jeopardy to not give him the double credits for that time period, in part because under 706.631, a judgment of a sentence of probation is tentative for purposes of Chapter 706. Talking about revoking probation, those sorts of things. So I think as long as you're under probation, you're still in jeopardy on the, it's still the first instance of jeopardy. So you can't say it's double jeopardy because it's a tentative judgment up until you're finished with probation. So
it's a punishment. He is serving time based on a sentence. Now it's a discretionary condition of probation sentence, but that's time. And he should get credit for the time he's serving. And that's that one chunk there, that one slice. I say didn't address that because
right.
I just went for the full 340, no can do. But I don't see any difference between the Pierce case and that little chunk of time. Tell me how that differs from Pierce.
Sure. Pierce simply says you're entitled to credit. It doesn't say how to apply it or deal with consecutive sentences at all. But in talking about the periods, there's about 70 days where he's serving that condition of probation from when he goes in May until he's released to go to drug court in July. And yeah, I think that's it is of a different nature because yes, he's received this jail time as a condition of probation
on all five cases. Right. He's serving it. He's got that in the bank.
It's interesting because the sentence of probation says the probation terms are concurrent. It doesn't say anything about the jail sentences. Those are presumably concurrent, but that's left unexplained in the sentence. But I would still say that if we take the person who is in Mr. Vaden's shoes but does not receive that jail sentence, that person is just on probation, and they do everything the same as Mr. Vaden. They violate probation. They get resentenced to the consecutive sentences. Now we have that person is going to serve objectively more jail time than Mr. Vaden because Mr. Vaden is being credited twice for every day that he spent in jail. And I think that goes against the underlying logic of Taulia-Ely.
Could I ask your help as well on the language of Section 2 as it refers to a crime? The language, Mr. Ross, that I referred to before, you know, where it says that after the sentence is vacated and a new sentence is thereafter imposed upon the defendant for the same crime. What is that referred to with respect to this case? What would be the crimes in this case? Is it in terms of the consecutive sentence, is it the portion that's the concurrent and another crime being the 10 years that was added consecutive, or do you define crime differently?
That's a good question. I think crime has to be taken as the counts, but at the same time, you're looking at these them separately because there's ones that are being served concurrently and then there's ones that are supposed to be served consecutively.
Okay.
So one thing I would say about the statute, and this is noted in...
Well, if you define it the second way, where you've got two crimes in terms of the two segments, you know, the 10-year crime and the other segment of the concurrence, then this language would suggest that there is a required deduction, even if it's a consecutive sentence. I mean, it's a required deduction from both. Right. If you read it that way,
the stat. Yeah.
Unless you engraft, as Justice McKenna was saying, it somehow engraft Taulia-Ely into that language to say, except for consecutive sentences, which isn't there.
Well, it talks about the way the first sentence of subsection two ends is shall be deducted from the minimum and maximum terms of the new sentence. And I think the way you look at the sentence is as a whole, his entire sentence that he received, which in this case was consecutive sentences totaling 15 total years.
Mr. Ross, do you know your argument about that if someone is serving jail time as a term and condition of probation, that time served in jail should not be counted towards, is that what you're saying? Should not be counted towards a sentence if the probation is eventually revoked and the person is sentenced to, say, like an open five?
I'm saying it should be counted once. It should be counted once for their entire aggregate sentence.
So, then that includes the term. So that's what I'm confused about. When you say counted once, you mean counted as a term and condition of probation? Can it be all? Why can't it be counted at when? Say it's a 5-year term. You're saying if the person serves 1 year as a term and condition of probation, and then the probation gets revoked, he doesn't get credit when he gets the five-year term.
No, I'm saying he gets the credit. He serves four more years. He does not get...
Well, what are you talking about not counting it twice then? I don't understand what you mean by that then.
Well, because here he received 340 days of credit. That included the time he was in jail. So he received 341 days off his ultimate 15-year sentence. So he had slightly over 14 years left. What petitioner wants is 680 days. So he really only wants to serve, you know, approximately 13 more years instead of 14.
So in your view, is this case governed by Section 2 completely, or should we analyze separately the pre-sentence versus the post-sentence periods of time and apply Section 1 to the pre-sentence and Section 2 to the post?
I think both should apply. I think subsection 1 is clearly directed at the pre-sentence detention. And because it's the most direct on-point subsection of the statute, I would say subsection 1 should apply to everything pre-sentence.
Ms. Russ, can I ask you just something, how it works on Maui? You know, the ICA sort of threw up their hands. You know, we had 340. We don't know if it's subsection 1, subsection 2 type of credit. And I think that was a product of there not being a certificate of detention. Under 706-671, both subsections, a certificate of detention needs to be provided to the court before sentencing. And also, it should be attached to the court documents, which I take to mean the judgment. One problem here was, and in fact, the dates I threw out earlier were just gleaned from the trial docket. Are certificate of detentions provided before sentencing in the Second Circuit?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I can't really speak to that in as a general practice.
Okay. Because it's clear in the statute that they should be, right?
Yeah, I would agree that's clear in the statute.
With respect to the sentencing, Mr. Ross, I just wanted to be clear about the record in terms of the resentencing. When his probation with drug court was revoked and he received the 15-year consecutive sentence, what were the violations during the six-month period?
There was a use of drugs. I know that. And yeah. He asked to self-terminate from drug court.
Yes, it appears he asked to self-terminate. So would it be fair to say that based on this record, the reason, and I think Justice Edens did refer to the statements made by the judge, but I just want to be clear from your point of view, would the reason that he did receive the consecutive sentence of 15 years is because of the plea agreement, because he essentially agreed that he'd get a consecutive sentence?
Well, I think that was certainly part of it. I'm not saying that the circuit court didn't make his own judgment in that regard.
Well, I mean, this is why I asked the question, because you've got somebody who's in his 30s, and he's, as I say, virtually no criminal history prior to this. His violation is just that he relapsed, and he was given 15 years of incarceration. So it seems like if you were to look at the facts, you could say it was a pretty brutal sentence, but if you're looking at just the legal agreement, the plea agreement, then I suppose that offers more of an explanation. So that's why I asked you about the facts. If there's something particularly egregious that would mean that he'd get 15 years in prison with that kind of a history.
Well, I mean, the sheer number of charges in five separate cases, I think, cut in favor of a longer sentence. But
okay.
In terms of especially egregious.
But was there I don't think a pre-sentence report was ordered in this case, right?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, so from that point of view, it might indicate that the judge wasn't that concerned about looking at the individual facts because there was a plea agreement and he didn't even request that there be a pre-sentence report, right?
Well, it's difficult to speculate on what the circuit court may or may not have been considering, but it has to be considered that Mr. Vaden did get a several items, a dismissal of the Class A felony, yeah, and also the ability to participate in drug court as a condition.
Sure. Just makes the point about how it was part of the plea agreement. He agreed that the Class A would be dismissed, and therefore he gets 15 years, and he doesn't get the benefit of necessarily a hearing on any kind of violation. Just the mere... Okay.
He could have, had he not chosen to self-terminate. I mean, that could have been litigated if he was contesting whether or not he violated.
Mr. Rawson, speaking to Mr. Justice Wilson's calling this a brutal sentence, wouldn't the defense attorney have been justified in this plea agreement, considering the first case involved 15 counts, including burglary, theft, not just drug counts, right? Although, you know, drugs usually are involved, credit card theft, unlawful use of a credit card, possession of confidential information, and the subsequent one was a Class A felony, which is a mandatory 20 years.
Right. You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. You know, he was facing 20 years on that single count, and that count was the one that got dismissed. So he certainly could have ended up with a much, much longer sentence absent this plea deal.
I still don't understand what you're saying, how equalization applies to Section 2.
Well, let me try again, because I must not be doing a very good job. I'm sorry. I think equalization should apply to Subsection 2 insofar as the person who is sentenced to a year, for example, of jail time as a condition of probation, and a person who is not sentenced to a year of jail time as a condition of probation, they just go on probation, are not in custody at all. If they both violate and both get the same ultimate sentence, they should serve the same amount of time. You should not count the 1 year the person who went to jail served twice. You should count it once.
Okay.
And that would result in them serving the same aggregate sentence.
Okay. It's based on what you're sentenced to, not on ability to post bail.
I'm sorry?
It's based on what you were sentenced to as a condition of probation, not on whether you were able to post bail. But you're just talking about it should be the same for people with the conditions of probation.
Right. Okay. I mean, Taulili says it should be the same regardless of whether or not you post bail. I'm saying that should extend to whether or not you go into jail as a condition of probation.
Why is that? Could you explain the thinking? I mean, there's obviously a very clear rationale for the subsection one principle of, you know, we don't want to penalize people for not having resources. How is it that applies here? What's the policy that's being served by what you're advocating for?
The policy that's being served is everyone serving the same amount of time and not rewarding people who happen to receive jail time as a condition of probation. Because if you get jail time as a condition of probation and it's counted twice or three times or four times, depending on how many sentences or cases you have or however the court chooses to draw the rule in that case, then you're serving less time in the aggregate. If it's being counted more than once, you get an objectively shorter sentence. And it doesn't make sense to say, well, okay, you served this time before you violated probation, therefore we're going to count this time twice and you're going to serve less time. You're going to get out a year earlier than the person who didn't go to jail as a condition of probation. And that makes no sense, and it violates the principle that Taulili discussed.
Help me with that. We're talking about an imaginary person who doesn't post bail. And we want to make sure that this person doesn't somehow be treated differently because they didn't post bail. So for that reason, we're not going to give benefit to the one that can't post bail that gets incarcerated. I don't quite understand that the legislature would agree with this blanket determination that in every instance in which there is a person that doesn't post bail, they shouldn't be given the credit on resentencing because of the fact that there is this class of individuals that can post bail. I don't know why that would disqualify the person that can't post bail from getting the credit. It just seems to me there's some logic, as you say, to the concept that maybe they just didn't want any special credit being given to those that serve pretrial. But I don't see that it wouldn't be just as much of a rational basis for the legislature to say, you know, we're over incarcerating people. This is an extreme sentence, consecutive. It needs to be done carefully. And on resentencing, if the person who's got the consecutive sentence also served pretrial, they would get credit for it. So I just don't, I'm not persuaded that there's no rational basis for the language as it's written in the statute, and that we have to engraft onto it the idea that there's an exception when it comes to consecutive sentences.
Well, I would say that a couple of things. I mean, one, as I probably am belaboring at this point, you are getting the credit when you are detained and you can't post bail. You're just not getting it multiple times. So there is some credit to be given. The other thing I would point out is that pretty much the states pretty much unanimously have subscribed to the principle that Taulia-Yili adopted, which is you apply the credit to the aggregate, not multiple times for consecutive sentences. One of the cases Taulia-Yili relied on, the Indel versus Johnson case out of Alaska, actually, and this goes back to the petitioner's argument of the fact that there's multiple cases being the difference. Indel versus Johnson was two separate cases. It was two separate DWIs in Alaska. And despite the fact it was two separate cases, the Alaska Court of Appeals said, no, you still only get the credit applied.
Well, what was the language of the statute in Alaska?
I'm sorry?
What was the statutory language in Alaska?
It's definitely not the same. It's comparable, and that's
right.
Why Taulia-Yili cited that case. But
so plain language analysis, right? It does say you get pre-sentence detention credit. But just getting back to your argument on subsection 2, I'm trying to understand. Okay, so let's say that someone pleads guilty to two separate cases, one count each, drug offenses, 5-year drug offenses. And initially they get probation with a year. And every time they come out, they immediately reoffend. So they get back, taken back, and they're resentenced many times, right? Let's say four times. And then finally, the court says, okay, no, you're only going to get credit. You'll get the credit for the 4 years on the first count, but I'm going to do the second count consecutive. And now you don't get anything. That's what you're saying would be the result.
I'm saying that if they serve 4 years, they should get 4 years off the aggregate total sentence. Yes.
But not off the second one. And that's based on what? Taulia-Yili?
Yes, I mean, that is what Taulia-Yili held in the subsection 1 category. And
you think Taulia-Yili is consistent with the plain language of the statute?
Yes, because Taulia-Yili is applying it to the sentence as a whole, and that the statute does refer to reducing it from the sentence. So here his sentence was 15 years total. It's taken off his sentence.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Russ, anything else?
Sorry, Your Honor. Let me
take a moment to review.
The one other point I'd like to make, just on the single case, multiple case distinction, is this court had that issue somewhat in front of it in State versus Abahai, which had two separate cases. And, Taulia-Yili was distinguished in Abahai, but only on the basis of the fact that Taulia-Yili dealt with consecutive sentences, not concurrent sentences. So that there's no basis in under Taulia-Yili or Abahai or any other Hawaii Supreme Court case that I'm aware of to draw the distinction at the number of cases. So with that, I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Very well, thank you for your argument. Mr. Lowenthal. Mr. Lowenthal, you have about a minute 20 left, but if you need to go over a bit, that's okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Justice Edens asked the experience on Maui as to certificates of detention. As a deputy public defender regularly appearing in district and circuit courts, I can say that certificates of detention for misdemeanors are almost non-existent when they stand alone. For felonies, a certificate of detention could only be provided if a pre-sentence report is requested, and even then, it's not always guaranteed. And so oftentimes, as in this case, we do not have the official jail credit calculation as determined by the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you.
The state throughout its argument treats the 15-year sentence as the aggregate. And I believe that is the crux of the problem here. In order to harmonize Tau Ili Ili, if Tau Ili Ili is going to remain firm, it needs to be harmonized with that line of cases from the 1990s of State versus Miller and State versus Brandt. Those were those cases that talk about the inability or the prohibition of a sentencing court to apply jail credit to other cases in the event of, say, a probation violation versus a new case. Miller states that the defendant is only entitled to credit for time served in connection with the criminal offense for which he or she is being sentenced. That principle is lost here because no credit was awarded for these particular offenses. And it is cannot be justified by saying it should be extinguished and transferred over to the unrelated cases. That is the crux of the problem. My time is up, and unless the court has any other questions, thank you.
Very well. Any further questions from the court? Anything further you wanted to say in summary, Mr. Lowenthal?
In summary, one day of credit does not accurately reflect the time that was actually served in this case. And
maybe I could ask, since we talked about Tau Ili Ili so much, what's your view about whether the legislature necessarily intended that it would be necessary to not provide credit to those who have been sentenced and have served pretrial, because to do so would mean that they, on resentencing, they would receive more credit than a person who could post bail pretrial?
The Tau Ili Ili and the equalization rationale does contemplate a situation where, well, I should start by saying that equalization, if it is to remain a viable rationale, should be confined to situations of those who can afford to post bail and those who cannot, and not a situation where a person is sentenced to probation with jail time and someone who's sentenced to probation without. But if we are to glean the policy from the plain language of the statute, I just wish to be very, very clear about this, is that I know there was discussion about the applicability of question of subsections 1 and 2. I do not mean to be ambiguous and unclear, but I understand Justice McKenna's pointing out that subsection 2 does discuss detention and imprisonment. And so that there is a way to, it can be argued that subsection 2 is the only subsection that would apply here because it covers the period of time before the first sentencing.
If the equalization principle, it's referred to in the commentary though, isn't it?
Yes.
Anything further, Mr. Lowenthal?
No, thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much, Mr. Lowenthal, Mr. Ross. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Iku iluna, please rise.
Ua ho'o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha. Ho'o kolo kolo ki e hano hano o kamaku ana. or Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.